Origins, applications, and future directions. A roundtable discussion about the scholarly and public history contributions of environmental history. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 29 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Last month, I was fortunate enough to be asked to participate on a roundtable about environmental history at the New Frontiers in Graduate History Conference at York University in Toronto, Ontario. We were all asked to speak about our own experiences as environmental historians and to reflect on some of the origins of the subdiscipline, its scholarly and public history contributions, and its future prospects. I was joined on this roundtable by three prominent environmental historians from the Greater Toronto Area with expertise in a variety of areas of environmental history. Following my remarks, the first speaker was Richard Hoffman, Emeritus Professor from the Department of History at York University and distinguished researcher in the field of medieval environmental history. The next speaker on the roundtable was Colin Coates from Glendon College, who's also the director of the Robarts Center for Canadian Studies and the leader of NISHA's Landscape Project. And finally, Michael Egan from the Department of History at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, wrapped up the roundtable conversation. Luckily, we had a recorder with us to capture the audio from what turned out to be a very compelling roundtable session.
I think in a broader sense, there's a secondary category for thinking about environmental history beyond just a subset of topics related to the environment, and that is history that uses a revisionist interpretive framework for historical analysis that examines the past from a biological perspective. That is to say, shifting the focus of historical analysis from an anthropocentric focus on humans to a biocentric interpretation of the past that considers all forms of life and natural phenomenon as subjects of historical inquiry and, in some instances, agents of historical change. So specifically, I think that environmental history at this level best explains the limits of human agency and the extent to which non-human material forces can restrict or constrain or reshape human activity. And for historiographical purposes, I think it can help us to re-examine aspects of the past and interpret past events in different ways. And that's the first area that I think environmental history can make a significant contribution, that is, in terms of historiographical contributions. So for Canadian history or British history or modern European history, U.S. history, I think that taking this approach of looking at the past from a biological perspective can answer new questions and in some instances overturn past interpretations of past events. For example, we had a talk recently in the department by Boyd Cawthorn on the Modoc Indian War, the subject of his research, which we heard about a Native American Modoc tribe in Northern California, Southern Oregon border region that entered into armed conflict with the United States Cavalry over a period of nearly a year from July 1872 to June 1873, California's so-called last Indian War. But what we didn't hear about in that talk was the significance of horses and the significance of disease to that conflict. The Modoc Indian War persisted, I think, in part because of an epidemic of equine influenza that swept through North America in 1872 and 1873, which, according to reports from that war at the front, dismounted the cavalry for several weeks. During the course of the war, the Modoc successfully raided cavalry horse supplies, stealing horses from the cavalry as well as their allies. And in a number of key battles, were able to successfully escape and were able to successfully execute guerrilla war tactics because they had an advantage in the number of horses that they had over the cavalry, whose many horses were either sick or dead from this influenza epidemic that had spread over the winter of 1872-73. So I think this is just one example of the way in which overlooking biological factors and studying the past can in some ways disguise, mask, or obstruct the course of historical events. The equine influenza epidemic in 1872-73 during the Modoc War, I think, had a significant impact on the outcome of the war. And it had a significant impact on the information that reached newspapers and popular publications about the Modoc War, because most of that information was halted for a significant period of time because reporters couldn't get dispatches back to San Francisco and Los Angeles because their horses were dead. The second area I think environmental history makes a significant contribution is in policymaking, or policy formation. This kind of approach to studying the past from a biological perspective can make important contributions to decisions that policymakers make. A biocentric interpretation of past events can provide insights into the effects of past policy decisions. For example, Dean Babington's recent study in his book, Managed Annihilation, does just this by demonstrating the ways in which policymakers and scientific management of the Atlantic cod fishery by a succession of Canadian governments and bureaucrats ultimately failed to adequately meet the ecological needs of cod as a fish species, leading to its the collapse of the fishery in the 1990s. A biocentric interpretation of events can also be applied to current policy decisions then, shifting decision-making away from an anthropocentric approach to understanding contemporary policy problems. And this can have, I think, significant implications specifically for debates over the meaning of sustainability in environmental policy. Environmental history also subverts some of our conventional approaches to temporal analysis by extending time frames, in some instances, to very long and deep time periods. Some environmental historians consider not thousands of years, but tens of thousands of years into the past, and in some instances, millions of years into the past. And I think this can be quite useful for thinking about policy decisions, in a sense, by disrupting short-term thinking and asking policymakers to consider long-term policy implications as they relate to deep time and long-term changes in the past. So those are some of the contributions I think environmental history can make to the decisions that policymakers make. The final area of significant contribution environmental history can make is in the area of public history, because I think environmental history has a very powerful well-actually factor. That is to say, when contemporary discussions about even policy changes or understandings about the biographies of place, I think public memory of environmental change is relatively short for a variety of reasons, one of which I think is that it's difficult to commemorate environmental change, excluding, of course, major extreme disaster events such as Hurricane Katrina in 2007 or the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989 that struck the San Francisco Bay Area and disrupted the World Series. But outside of these extreme events of environmental change, and extreme events of environmental change that cause perhaps economic disruption or social disruption, I think public memory of environmental change is very short. And we can think of it even in our own lives when we try to remember what used to be in that place, what used to be where that building was built, what used to be where that subdivision was constructed, what it used to look like, what happened in that place. For the most part, we quickly forget these things. Popular memory in public history is very much anthropocentric in its focus. Environmental change can be sometimes too gradual to be commemorated. Or people become accustomed to the change very rapidly. And so I think environmental history can play a really useful role in documenting that change and playing a public history role by trying to get us to remember the ways in which the environment has been transformed. And in some instances, this can overlap with public policy debate and contemporary decisions that tend in some instances to be clouded by poor popular recollections of environmental transformations. For example, last year, the Plains Midstream Canada Limited, a major oil transport and pipeline corporation, suffered a massive pipeline spill on its Rainbow Pipeline east of the Peace River in northern Alberta. How many of you remember that happened? Right. They quietly announced this about a day or two after the federal election, even though it had occurred a day or two before the federal election in 2011. This was a 28,000 barrel crude oil spill in northern Alberta that the environment minister of that province, Rob Renner, told reporters that, sure, there are incidents from time to time, but I would put our record up against any other, and then offered no evidence of the record. So I started doing a little bit of digging, trying to understand, okay, is this actually a significant oil spill? When was the last time this happened? Various news reports, which failed also to follow up on the minister's comments, instead suggested that the last major pipeline spill in Alberta had occurred in 1975 at a Bow River, or at an undefined Bow River pipeline facility, which I was never able to dig up where this pipeline spill actually occurred. All the news reports just wrote that this pipeline facility had a rupture and was estimated to be about 41,000 barrels, but never said where it was or exactly when it happened. So I did a little bit of my own newspaper research to try and figure out how many oil spills had happened and taken place in Alberta or on pipelines operated by Alberta oil corporations since 1970. And I found that there had been 11 individual oil pipeline spills between 1970 and 1980, ranging from 1,000 barrels to 41,000 barrels of oil spilled. And along the main pipeline between Alberta and Ontario, between 1973 and 1975, there were several spills totaling about 119,000 barrels of oil. And according to the province's own statistics, between 1990 and 2005, Alberta's pipeline system suffered 4,769 pipeline releases of liquefied petroleum products, six incidents of which released between 6,300 barrels of oil and 63,000 barrels of oil. And in 2006, on the very same Rainbow Pipeline, there was a leak of 7,900 barrels of oil just 5 years before the 2011 leak. So I think in some instances these things get forgotten very quickly, and environmental history can remind us with this obnoxious well-actually factor that environmental change has in fact occurred, and that these changes have been forgotten by policymakers and by the public broadly. So those are three areas I think environmental history can make significant contributions.
Thank you. Thank you for having somebody who works on things that are all dead. I thought an interesting way to get you into where I am is to tell you what I've been working on in professionally in the last week to 10 days. I finished writing and editing about a 4,000 or 5,000 word piece of a chapter, and this piece is about medieval earthquakes, volcanoes, and human responses to these tectonic events. That got me interested to realize that there is a strong methodological parallel between the approaches of historical climatology and those of historical seismology, and I'm in fact using that as a segue to get from these earth-shaking events to atmospheric events in a chapter about the non-living environment. I also, in the course of the past week, prepared a seminar on the sustainability of medieval agroecosystems, largely those north of the Alps. I am reading a young colleague's accepted manuscript on water management in the medieval Ardennes, so my name can appear in a blurb somewhere that I think this is a fine piece of work. I've been in correspondence with a colleague with whom I will be writing a joint article on resource conflicts over salmon in the River Forth in Scotland. And last evening I was studying a new review article which seeks to look at the debate over the identification of the pathogenic agent for the Black Death. And I consider all of these things to be environmental history. Environmental history. I am a historian. I'm engaged in reconstructing and seeking to explain that foreign country which is the past. The piece of that foreign country that I explore is pre-industrial Europe. I am interested in establishing its attributes, both those similar to and different from our world of the present. I am interested in pursuing alternatives and various choices that people made and the processes of the impact upon those choices and the consequences of those choices. I seek, in general and practically all the time, to counteract present-day arrogance, the notion that people in the past were uninformed, stupid, ignorant, and just nowhere near as clever in handling all sorts of things as we are, since we are, of course, the climax of history. I want us rather to learn to respect our forebears' efforts and our forebears' humanity in a world that contains humans and contains a lot of things that aren't human. And those things that aren't human are what I call nature. Because I write environmental history, and environmental history is, for me, history as if nature matters. And that's a quotation I stole from my dearly, sorely missed colleague, the first self-conscious environmental historian at York University, L.R. Melville, who taught me that what I was doing, which I thought was agrarian economic history, was in fact working on the relationship between human beings and the natural world, writing about history as if nature matters. As I do that, I start from the heuristic of a hybridity of human society, human bodies, and all the biophysical things that humans do. We are participants in an autonomous world of culture. We are simultaneously participants in an autonomous world of nature. And we share both of those aspects in many different kinds of ways. If you start from that sense that our world is not a division between nature and culture, but with a very strong interaction between them, we recognize that nature affects humans and their culture. We recognize that humans and their culture affect the natural sphere. And somewhere in between, we encounter human thoughts about nature. These interest me just about only if those thoughts can be connected to experience in the natural world, action in the natural world, or preferably both. One of my puzzles about dealing with medieval thinking about nature is an awful lot of it seems utterly disconnected from both the way the natural world worked and was experienced and the way people actually functioned in the natural world during the medieval millennium. So that's always puzzled me. It puzzles me less when I see some people trying to function in our world as if there was no connection between their experience in the natural world and the ideas that they have as well. But these interactions between an autonomous cultural sphere and an autonomous natural sphere don't occur as these great amorphous conceptual things banging into each other. They occur in specific places, which we have come to call socio-natural sites, and they occur at specific times. Historians like time. We kind of rely on it in order to organize what it is we look at and what it is we talk about. So we can focus off, for instance, on the record that tells us how people who live beside the Danube in one portion of Austria related to the river that went by their doorsteps. It's not humans and nature. It's people in one village dealing with this big moving piece of nature that's next to them. A piece of nature that is both is physical in its elemental quality and contains strong biological elements because it's a habitat zone, both in the water and in the riparian zone. So we can, as we focus in on localities, places where people are engaged with the non-human world around them, we can identify themes and variations in how a past society worked with their natural world. We can talk about norms and exceptions, always, however, placing these in context and seeking an explanation that makes sense for those people in that time, in that world. You see, in environmental history, nature is a player. Nature is not just a stage set. It's not a bunch of trees and hills and waterfalls with the people running around in front of it carrying out all the action. Nature is part of the action. And what we are seeking to do is to learn and write the history of this changing nature and the people's interaction with it. Nature is as autonomous as the human cultures with which it interacts. And in consequence, A characteristic of doing environmental history is that we must necessarily be inter- and multidisciplinary. That means, and now I frighten half the good historians in the room, being comfortable with science. This thing you left behind in grade 10, or maybe mathematics, which you maybe had to endure through grade 11, or possibly even first year university. Frankly, you can't do environmental history if you're not prepared to sit down and read a scientific publication and figure out what it's doing, what the problem was that it was seeking to engage, how it brought evidence to bear, and how scientists would proceed in that discipline, would proceed to judge this. Different questions bring up different sciences. But we need to be able to read science critically and be able to know enough of the science to avoid ignorant error. What I refer to in talking with a forestry friend in Alberta, that the president of the university needs to know the green end of tree up, brown end down. When it's fish, pointy end first, wiggly end behind. Doesn't work the other way around. If you don't know that, you're going to really screw up your attempt to understand things. And right now, to give you a sense of the diversity that the people who I'm working with are engaged in, we are using archaeozoology, aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems, social metabolism, which is the study of the flow of energy and materials from a society into the other parts of the world around it and back. We are working with people who study the pedosphere, that's soils and the rocks beneath it, people who study the biosphere, as Sean has told you about, people who work in the atmosphere, which interconnects with both of those things. We are exploring instances in the natural world and in human society of abrupt change and of evolutionary change, and of trying to figure out when something is happening quickly, those things that people remember, as Sean was telling you, and happening so slowly that people think they have never changed, because we only see back a generation ourselves. Out of this, I believe we can get a contribution to the historians' issues, where human societies have been, what processes for change and for stability are part of our experience, and how that experience connects up with our present world. As somebody who works in a deeper past, I am interested in showing how the present is and is not unprecedented, and it matters a whole lot to keep straight what's new and what's not. That's what I do.
So what I'm going to talk about is about essentially how I became an environmental historian, or at least had that tag attributed to me, and I think this would be a warning for everybody here that this could happen to you too. It may be traced back, you know, we historians might like to trace things back sometimes, traced back to a conference, not a conference entirely unlike this, in the sense that it was at a time that just before I started my PhD program, so I was a little bit earlier on in my stages than most of the people in this room, but not that far from that. And I was coming back from China, where I'd spent a year I had a brief career as English as a foreign language teacher in China. I was on my way back in 1985 and ended up in Hawaii, of all places, where my brother was going to a conference, and my brother's an historian as well. And so I tagged along. One of the themes of this conference, and this was the American Historical Association Pacific Branch, was environmental history. Now, I had finished my MA a year and a half previously, but I wasn't really aware of this as a new field. And so I ended up in a session. Now, again, the memory is a little bit vague, but I'm pretty sure that it had three of the key figures in American environmental history: Carolyn Merchant, Bill Cronin, and Don Worster. I'm pretty sure it was them. I tried to find this on the web, or you can find a reference to it, but that's not digitized yet. But anyways, but there are two incidents that, of course, I don't remember much of the conference, and again, that's a bit of a warning to you too. But there's two incidents that stand out in my mind of that particular session. One was there was a very heated polemical discussion between Worcester and Cronin about woodchucks. Not sure why, but that was quite important. And the second one was a graduate student. And again, keep in mind, I was just about to enter the PhD program here at York. And a graduate student asked the question of the panelists, but are there any jobs in environmental history? Now, I don't actually remember the answer, but I did think it was a good question to ask. And I didn't actually ever expect that I'd be one asking that question myself, or certainly about myself. In fact, it wasn't for a long time that I began to be convinced that I was indeed an environmental historian, and I'll come to that a bit later on. Now, if that question was an important one for graduate students to consider, and I think the answer is a bit clearer than it was over 25 years ago, yes, there are some jobs in environmental history. Sean has one of them. But possibly as an echo of the conference, I later read, and was working on my dissertation, I later read Bill Cronin's key work, Changes in the Land, Indians, Colonists, and the Ecology of New England. Now, it's one of the many books one reads as you work on your dissertation, and it's only as I read it a few years ago, again, that I realized how important that work was in shaping my dissertation and what eventually became my first book. So my point is here is that a lot of us who get involved, who become involved in environmental history, have come to it by a rather circuitous route. Now, undoubtedly, some of us are inspired by environmental activism, and particularly about concerns about human-induced global warming. Keep in mind that the mid-80s were a period like that as well, in a sense that environmental issues were, briefly perhaps, at the forefront of Canadian concerns. Brian Mulroney's erstwhile pal, Lucien Bouchard, was the Minister of the Environment, and that was considered a plum post because he could actually do something with it. Well, things changed after that. But environment has been a key issue. A lot of hot summers around the mid-80s, and people were concerned about that. Environmental history has undoubtedly evolved in this context of concern about changes to the climate. But we could also consider that we're inspired by older concerns within historical geographical literature as well, with people like Cole Harris, who talked about relationships of humans with land, grave, wind, and so on. Or by newer concerns within geographical theory, theories about space in particular attract some people to environmental history. We're concerned about the very physical locality in which human activity occurs. But environmental history is still a relatively new subdiscipline, though there are some key works to which it can at least retrospectively lay claim. Now, whenever a subdiscipline exists or arises, there's a certain level of desire to create boundaries around it. And I'm reminded of the advice that Chad Gaffgail, who had been editor of the Journal des Sciences Sociales and Social History, gave me at one point when I took over the editorship for a few years. And I was expressing some concern about the types of papers that came in, about what we could consider social history and what wasn't social history. And he said, and I thought it was actually pretty wise advice, the definition of social history for the Journal des Sciences Sociales is determined precisely by those people who wish to submit papers to the journal. Didn't want to call yourself a social historian, you wouldn't submit your journal there. Well, I think there was at least one paper that really shouldn't have gone there. But anyway, but mostly that's a fair definition. In other words, I think that for environmental history, it should comprise those who actually wish to claim that they're environmental historians. My personal principal entree into the world of environmental history occurred when I received an email from Alan McEachern, who teaches at the University of Western Ontario, called Western these days, in 2004, when he asked me to sign on to a grant application to promote environmental history in Canada. But, I protested, I'm not an environmental historian. Yes, you are, he said. After all, the research chair that I was fortunate to be appointed to the year previously was named Canadian Cultural Landscapes, he said. Now, little did he know that was merely a desperate attempt on my part to ascribe some coherence to my own scholarly interests. And in fact, landscapes and culture were probably equally important in that phrase, not just the landscapes part. But I went along with it. And that began the adventure with NICHE, the Networking Canadian History and Environment, or in French, La Nouvelle Initiative Canadienne en Histoire de l'Environnement, which worked really well for the first few years, but Nouvelle, as we get into our ninth year now, I think it is, or eighth year, maybe not so good. Anyways, NICHE came out of a call for proposals for a new type of funding, which was called Research Clusters Design Grant. In other words, the funding was pretty limited in the first instances, was for developing links between scholars. It wasn't for research, it was for developing links. And I actually did some historical research on this by going into my old emails and finding that first email from Alan McEachern, and he said, the quotation was, "The proposal is to help build a Canadian environmental history network." That was about it. Now, we did receive that first modest grant, and then a second modest grant. And with those grants, we ran what has come to be known as CHESS, the Canadian History and Environment Summer School. We're really good at acronyms. And we developed a textbook called Method and Meaning in Environmental History, edited by Alan McEachern and Bill Trickell. Building on that work, we applied for a larger grant, a much larger grant, when it was announced. Now, Alan, I will admit, he did really all the almost all the heavy lifting in that, and we ended up getting this grant, and it was $2.1 million, which to an historian is an extraordinary amount. Even to eight historians, as we were, it's still an extraordinary amount. But strangely enough, this money was not to be used for the purposes that we historians normally know how to spend things on. For instance, hiring researchers or going to archives ourselves. We're not allowed to spend it on that. Rather, it's to be spent on dissemination and networking, whatever those things are. Now, a number of initiatives have come to light as a result of this niche grant, one of which is Sean's tremendously successful podcast series, available through the Niche website and through iTunes. Members of the Niche executive have been involved in special issues of journals like BC Studies, Environmental History, the Journal of Environmental History, La Revue d'Astronomie Française, Globe, Revue des Sciences Québécoises, and so on. We've edited collections, we've run field trips, we've run summer schools and so on, and we've done other activities. But that's just those of us in the executive. But probably more importantly, the broader environmental history community has been engaged in developing their own projects, some of which Niche has been able to fund. Online seminars and exhibits, the EHTV broadcasts that were referred to earlier, drama presentations for school-aged children, extensive mapping collections, support for the main conference in the field, the American Society for Environmental History, which is coming to Toronto next year, by the way, and so on. Now, has this work with Niche been enough to bolster environmental history in Canada? I think we'll only know the answer to that when the money runs dry and we see what enthusiasm sustains it. In the early days of Niche, it struck me that environmental history in Canada was in more or less the same place as women's history had been in the 1980s and the 1990s in Canada. It is sustained by people who are committed to the field and to the intellectual and activist enthusiasms that are associated with it. But I do think that over the last decade or so, that environmental history has become one of the most vibrant sub-disciplines, at least in Canadian historiography, in recent years. So again, going back to that graduate student's question, are there jobs in it? Yes, there have been some jobs explicitly denoted as environmental history jobs. As mentioned, Sean, obviously, has one of those jobs, and at York, but there are three other institutions as well. What I do hope is that historians will find academic homes outside of history departments as well, particularly in environmental studies programs. To my mind, the key questions in environmental studies, things like global warming, really any environmental change, these are fundamentally historical questions, and I believe that historians are able to provide a context for understanding these key concerns. A further thought to add about environmental history is the fact that it is added to the Sean's list of areas that it contributes to. It's one of the few places where an older and once stately subdiscipline in Canadian history, economic history, can be pursued. There aren't a lot of economic historians these days. And I have to say, there's probably even fewer jobs with the designation of economic historians. But I think that a number of people who are pursuing what are essentially economic history topics have done that through environmental history. Things like looking at the extraction of natural resources, which is rather important in Canadian history, and the impacts of those extractions. So, again, ending with the job issue, this is a fairly dire time in academic hiring, I hate to tell you that. Things may change in a few years, one never knows. It was fairly dire in the early 1990s as well. And a number of us Canadian historians, people training in Canadian history, found jobs in areas like Canadian studies. In fact, of the three people who graduated in my cohort, two of us found jobs initially in Canadian studies. Some of us have never left it. But I think it's important to keep in mind that intellectual flexibility as we pursue our work. So we have to think not just in terms of environmental history for historians, but environmental history for other areas of scholarship as well. Thanks.
I'd like to preface my remarks by stating that an hour ago I was supposed to go first. And trying to define environmental history after these three gentlemen does a terrific job that really is so I want to talk sort of reflexively about a few things here. First of all, building off of Colin's comments about field job market and the state of environmental history in Canada, McMaster has actually just launched its PhD program in environmental history. We are currently going through comps readings with our first two PhDs in environmental history. That's been both gratifying, exciting, and it could be career suicide for them, but we're excited that we have a field dedicated to environmental history. Right, well, I want to talk just briefly, sort of, I guess maybe to try to rip off of the three previous speakers, to talk a little bit about what it is we're studying in environmental history, what environmental history is, to come back to Sean's original question, and more to point out, how does it work? I think the only thing I had left on my checklist of what is environmental history that wasn't touched upon already was a redefinition of place and how historians can think about place differently when we situate it in that biocentric kind of framework and mentality. A lot of the very early environmental history changes in the line going forward were effectively landscape biographies, if you like. They took a place, whether it was a consistent ecosystem or a bioregion of some kind, that sort of in some capacity or a particular watershed really challenged human-derived political boundaries as being artificial when it came to telling ecologically driven histories. But what's been kind of interesting over the last couple of months, I wish I'd been as productive as Richard over the last fortnight, and I want to leave this term as well, so I have no excuse. In developing this major field and going through readings, it's been an exciting opportunity for me to revisit the field, sort of go back and do readings in ways that I haven't done since I was in grad school myself, and sort of revisit questions of what is this field and what is it we're doing? And I'm embarrassed to say I don't know. I'm more lost now than I think I was before. And I want to suggest that's a good thing. I'll sort of circle back and try to defend that. Environmental history, I think, as Sean, Richard, and Colin have certainly indicated, is a wildly eclectic field. I think it's practitioners or people who are willingly accepting of the label environmental historians, I don't think anyone here would disagree with me, still sort of cling to this notion that it's a relatively young field. You know, 40 is the new 25.
Or 15.
Or 15, yeah. But there's something really sort of, I think, encouragingly inclusive about the field. If you go to the ASDH meeting, you're not surrounded just by historians. We have people working, Richard sort of listed a variety of disciplines that he's reading, and we have people from those disciplines not just attending the conference, but presenting. Anthropologists, geographers, ecologists, conservation biologists, sociologists, political scientists, who all find ways to sort of fit into sort of the conference themes. And I think it's fair to say they're wildly embraced. I mean, I think we really sort of thrive on that kind of inclusiveness. A lot of older sort of subdisciplines of history have those defining parameters of what constitutes a field and what's on the outside. Environmental history doesn't do that, or doesn't do it yet. And my fear is that's coming. In 1986, Richard White wrote probably the first large synthetic historiographic review of the field, and he sort of said it took me all summer to do the readings in preparation for this. John McNeil wrote a similar sort of follow-up piece in 2003, where he sort of said, you know, the field's grown so exponentially it's going to take 100 years to do the comparable kinds of readings that Richard White was able to do. So there's been incredible growth, and within that then there comes a question of, well, what is the field? What are we doing? And I want to suggest that there are three ways of sort of defining the field or thinking about environmental history writ large. First, I think probably the standard interpretation is as a subdiscipline of history. It fits in there with sort of geographic focuses or various thematic focuses, maybe history of science, why not, and history of technology, why not environmental history is a way of thinking about it. Another maybe slightly more provocative one, but in tune with the Frontiers Conference, or speakers therein, nature as a category of analysis, as we think about paths, which I think is gaining some currency. You don't need to be an environmental historian trained in environmental history to recognize, I think, some of the points we've been making up here, that the non-human world, the physical environment, nature, matters in terms of how you tell your political histories, your economic histories, your social histories, your cultural histories. Place matters, climate matters, resources matter. In fact, in many ways, they're drivers behind these stories. And you could think of environmental history sort of trying to nudge the entire field in that kind of direction. And the third has been proposed by J.M. Powell in Australia, but also J. Donald Hughes and a few others. Environmental history is not really a subdiscipline or a category of analysis. It is its own thing. It's its own interdiscipline, if you like, sort of feeding off of what Richard was suggesting in terms of the interdisciplinarity involved. I don't have an answer. I think they're all valid, equally valid and invalid in different kinds of ways. And at the end of the day, given that the field is so inclusive, I don't think it, well, I don't particularly care right now. I think there are as many ways to be thinking about doing environmental history as there are ways to do it. That came out wrong. Okay. Moving on. But I want to come back to interdisciplinarity. So it's something that's really sort of driving my interest in work right now, and would echo and nod vigorously to much of what Richard was saying in terms of our engagement with the sciences. We treat sources and archives differently in environmental history. Dendrochronology is as valuable as an archive as source if you're interested in weather patterns or fire histories. You can tell an awful lot by just looking at tree rings. Narrow tree rings will tell you that it was a particularly dry year in some areas, whereas thicker space between them will suggest that it was a wetter year. You can see where the tree can start 150 years ago in ways that can be, suggest all kinds of things, which can help with your collection of information when it comes to environmental history. So, following on from Richard, again, I think we environmental historians need to draw on, but also must be conversant in all manner of fields. The ones that I tend to look at more closely are far more, I want to say benign, I shouldn't compare it to what Richard was listing, but I'm very in chemistry at the moment, but also ecology, biology, and general fields. These are fields that, again, one, and as one of those people who gave up high school science around 10 or 11, great. It's been a real epiphany to come back to this and have an excuse to play in things that I wish I had the patience and the discipline to study as a teenager. But also, I want to stress, not only do we need to understand or be somewhat conversant in the science, but we also need to be conversant in the histories of those sciences as well. What did we know and when matters almost as much as what does the science tell us now? There's a danger in environmental history in a lot of studies where we treat nature as an actor, as a dynamic, fluid actor in our human past, but the science is static. Here's what we know. Here's the knowledge. Here's the information. And I think good environmental history that draws on the science needs to borrow in a lot of ways from the history of science, which treats nature as static, but takes knowledge as a continually moving and dynamic subject of study. And I think to do good environmental history, to do good history of science, we need to find ways to put everything in flux and everything in motion, which can be almost as harrowing as knowing the science and knowing this history as going forward. There's also been a recent call to talk more about social theory as well, which is something I'm kind of on the fence about. I'm a big advocate of environmental history's contemporary relevance, which I think feeds off of a number of the comments Sean was making at the beginning of the roundtable. I'm very interested in this notion of history being useful If we're going to talk about a sustainable future, we need the most and best information available. And that's not just economic, political information, it's not scientific. Historical context is vitally important. It's a missing voice at any kind of future planning kind of table. So there are places for this. But at the same time, engaging with STS, or Science and Technology Society, and science studies, I think it's something I'd like to see more environmental historians thinking about as well. Again, there's an eclecticism in both of those fields in ways that I think are in parallel with what we do, but also I think they ask interesting questions that obviously have profound impacts on how we might think about our topics and areas of study and pursue them further. I was asked a little while ago about what kind of methodologies I brought to my work. And I didn't have an answer. Well, I'm a historian. I study the physical environment and its past and its and human interactions with various aspects of it. I'm currently working on a global history of mercury pollution and the history of knowing and regulating mercury in the physical environment. And I didn't have a good answer. I mean, beyond sort of describing what I do and how historians go about doing what historians do, I wasn't really sure how to answer this. And my friend and our colleague at the University of Guelph, Stuart McCook, fed me a line, which I'm going to claim as my own. It's what he does, and he made it up. But I think it's absolutely brilliant. And again, to sort of shift how we think about history, how we approach it, how environmental history might give us somewhat differently. He says he engages in a methodology of following. He and I are both global environmental historians, or try to be as much as possible. And what that entails is it is following our subject. For him right now, it's the copperas virus, for me it's mercury, and following it around to its sites, to its places, rather than putting a human stamp on how to tell the story, following the physical environment, non-human actors, in terms of telling the story. And it's a huge challenge. I've been working on this for close to a decade now, and I can give you a book prospectus, but I don't have a table of contents because I don't know how to organize what I've got still. But there's something to this notion of following non-human nature and letting it dictate the story or the narrative flow, if you like, that I think is important. The other two themes that I'm really quite interested in, not quite methodologies, but the themes to keep in mind, Sverker Sahlin, a Swedish colleague of ours, has introduced the notion of environing, which he talks about as, or describes as being the human process of becoming environmentally aware. And I think, whether you're an environmental historian or not, there are methods of thinking about environing that can be useful in terms of shaping and changing perceptions of the physical world around us in useful kinds of ways. I think it goes back to cities changing or places changing on some level, but us becoming acutely aware of those changes, I think, is really valuable. And following up on following motility, I'm really interested in how things move, not just people, and not just peoples and ideas necessarily, but non-human actors as well, how they create sort of a dynamic flow. Let me just finish, though. For all this talk about interdisciplinary, I want to come back to, I guess, what should be more familiar to most of you as historians in general is the notion of narrative and notion of the past. For all this talk about interdisciplinarity, environmental historians are still bound to the rules and lessons of the historian. But we also need to write like historians and tell stories to is central to what we do, and I think it's also why we're important. Yes, we need to be conversing with science. Yes, we need to be thinking about policy. Yes, we need to be forward-looking in what we do, trying to engage audiences beyond our parents and the three scholars in our field who might be interested in the work we're doing. But we are first and foremost storytellers. And storytelling is the primary method of human communication. This is my stump speech, if you like, for senior undergraduate students and graduate students at MAC. We are effectively, humans communicate through stories, and we as a profession, we're the descendants of Homo, and we suck at telling stories. We are not very good at communicating to anyone beyond our immediate followers. And that's a real problem. I think environmental history is a younger field, I would argue is a more vibrant field than most. Maybe doesn't marginally better. I think we've been very fortunate to have as senior leaders and makers and builders of the field, the Cronins, Worcesters, merchants that Colin described earlier, of having some profoundly gifted writers and storytellers at the helm of the field. But man, I think as a discipline writ large, not just environmental history, but history in general, we need to be more interesting. Because what we do is intrinsically so. And we find ways to let journalists sell more books than we do on our topic, on our field. And that's troubling, both from a professional development perspective, but also from, I think, a larger social and cultural one. I think we need to revisit and rethink how we tell stories and whether there are ways that we should be rethinking how we tell those stories and whether it's a 21st century iteration or whether it's just us having lost, you know, gotten too buried into the encounter. But I think this feeds off of a number of the points Sean was making at the beginning in terms of aiding and abetting policy decisions, engaging in public history. We ought to have a bigger voice than we do. And that, I think, boils down to the individual historian, but I think collectively in terms of how we drive and engage the field. Very quickly, some challenges. Non-human actors can be boring. Having said all that, environmental historians do have some challenges. My fortnight, which wasn't nearly as productive as Richard's, stemmed from my trying to describe elemental mercury's biogeochemical flow and cycle. And I spent the week writing five beautiful, beautiful pages on how this works. I am in contaminated the whole damn thing. I think it's gorgeous. And I looked at this last night, and I thought, God, even I'm bored. And basically refined it down to mercury goes up in the air, it comes back down, it does it again, sometimes it gets stuck in people. We've done a pretty good job of adding more mercury to this site. Use a couple of different words, but there were, the challenge, I think, for environmental historians, I think historians in everywhere, but environmental historians especially, is to take complicated technical data and information when it comes to the scientific material and otherwise, and make it accessible for a broader audience. I think this is the gift of storytelling. It's why the suggestion of sitting down with a specialized science journal is intimidating to, I think, even environmental historians, is because they don't write good. It's very formulaic, it's very hard to follow, even for these specialists in the field. We're storytellers, and we need to find ways to communicate that information as we're possible. I'll stop there. Thank you.
This week, we have some exciting news to announce. The Environmental History mobile application has now landed in the Apple iTunes App Store. You can now go today and download for free and install a copy of EH Mobile. To find out a little bit more about this project, I'm sitting down here with Jim Clifford, the co-producer of the EH Mobile application project. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Sean.
So, Jim, tell the audience a little bit about what this project is. What is EH Mobile?
Well, the idea is to bring a wide range of environmental history content from the internet into one place, currently on an Apple iPhone, allowing you to quickly check the latest blog entries, news from NICHE and other environmental history organizations, environmental history Twitter feeds, check out the latest issue of the journal Environmental History, and you can even listen to this podcast.
That's right. So this is an aggregator app. It's pulling in content about environmental history from all around the world. So this isn't just Canadian environmental history content, is it?
No, we have feeds from Europe and the United States and even one from Australia, I believe.
And through the aggregator app, you can get announcements, blog posts, video podcasts, audio podcasts, and as you said, you can even access the mobile version of the Environmental History Journal straight through the app.
Exactly. It's a format that will be familiar to most people who use an iPhone regularly, with four tabs and content in a variety of formats. So I think it's an exciting addition to the growing number of options for reading environmental history content. And hopefully over time, there'll be more and more blogs and other web-optimized content that we can feed into this app.
Now, if a listener wants to download this application right now, what do you have to do?
I think the simplest way is through the App Store. Just search for Environmental History Mobile, and you'll find us. You'll quickly see the recognizable niche blue maple leaf as our logo in the App Store.
And this is absolutely no cost. This is a free app.
This is totally free, and maybe that's a moment to thank our sponsor, which is, of course, the Network on Canadian History and Environment.
That's right. So I encourage listeners to go to the App Store now, search Environmental History Mobile, and download a copy of the Environmental History Mobile app for iOS devices. This can be run on an iPhone, it can be run on an iPod Touch, and you can even run it on an iPad at this point. Jim, thanks for coming in. Tell us a little bit more about Environmental History Mobile.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Richard Hoffman, Colin Coates, Michael Egan, Jim Clifford, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave us comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow Nature's Past on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have any new ideas for future episodes, or you want to send me some feedback, contact me through my website at seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.